Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Austrian Macroeconomics, the fifth lecture in our course. I don't want to make you envious, but it's a beautifully sunny day here and 70 degrees. For those of you who are more northern climates, you may very well be envious. So I want to start where I left off last class. We went through some of the laws of human action that relate to production and capital. And we now have this diagram, which I ended with last class. And it shows how people will act based on some basic fundamental laws of human action in choosing production processes. Okay, so just to review what I said last week, people will always tend to choose, will always choose the shorter and most productive processes first. So obviously, if you live in a bountiful or on a bountiful island, and there are fish, just streams teeming with fish, you would, instead of building a boat with a net, you may be able to actually start fishing, and just by going into the water and literally picking fish up, okay? Because you might be able to actually, you know, produce 10 fish per hour that way. And with a boat and net going out into the ocean, a boat would take you 6 months to build. You may not have any more productivity than that. It might only be eight fish per hour. So people always be rational in the sense that they will always prefer more to less. So they always want to maximize their utility, and the more of a good that they have, the higher their utility, the greater their satisfaction. So they would first choose that production process, that very short and very productive production process, actually going to the water and just wading in and picking the fish up, because it's more productive and it's shorter. It gives them their ends much more quickly than building the net and the boat. So there's no reason to choose a longer process of production. However, after a while, let's say the fish in the interior streams will become less and less plentiful. So at some point, maybe when it gets down to one fish per hour, two fish per hour by hand, people will then people on that island will then engage in the longer but less but more but longer and more productive. Okay, so here, let me just show you that. So we will go from, here, this box, down to this box, okay? So we always choose this first. There may be also, constructing a fishing pole might be productive, not as productive as maybe the longer process of building the boat and the net, but productive because it's shorter. It may be preferable. So they might be able to build take 1 day to construct the fishing pole, and they may be able to catch six fish per hour right away. Okay, whereas to catch eight fish per hour might take them another 6 months. So that might not be enough. Those extra two fish per hour might not be enough to overcome their time preference. Okay, that is to receive their satisfaction as soon as possible. So what we do know, though, is that no one will ever knowingly choose that box there. Okay, that is a longer process that is less productive than an available shorter process. Okay, or less productive than some other longer process. So less productive, longer processes never get chosen. The shorter, more productive ones always get chosen first. And then after that, you may very well choose some longer ones that are more productive because they're more productive than certain other shorter ones. So that's the message of that chart. So I have this, let me put it up a little further. So no one will choose a longer, less productive, just reading the slide here, productive processes of production when they can get an equal or greater quantity of goods from the shorter processes. OK? Okay, so that's an important lesson. And people will only choose longer, more productive processes if there are sufficient savings available to produce the necessary processes. So, in other words, you would have to have saved up some fish through shorter processes before you could even work full time, let's say, for 6 months on the net and the boat. And so that abstaining from consuming all the fish that you're producing in the current period, that is known as saving. Okay, so but before you can have any longer process chosen, you must have undertaken a shorter process and saved. And I will show you this with an example, a much more involved example. So let me just go to the next slide. Okay, so let me just, as I said, I have a little more complex example, but I think it gets the point across. You can forget the last two columns here, building time and total capital. That's not what's important. This comes out of a journal article, and it's a little bit more involved. But what we're interested in for tonight are the first three columns of boxes. So let's say someone lands on this island, and it's period T sub zero. Okay, that's the first period. And in that period, the stranded, the fictional castaway, Robinson Crusoe, doesn't have any tools. He has his hands. He has the element of his environment, which we call land and economics. But that includes any sort of nature-given resource, including fish in a stream, including fruit hanging on a tree, and so on. So at this point, we're not capital goods. There's just human energy, and there's these natural resources. So let's assume for the moment, and these are all hypothetical figures, that he can enjoy 12 hours of leisure, and that's an immediately available good. Okay, remember, leisure is necessary for any sort of consumption, and it's also a good in itself. To enjoy anything, you always need a leisure. And let's say that he chooses to work 12 hours, so he allocates his labor to catching fish. And he catches them in a very, very rude manner with his hands, as we said. Now, at this point, there's no saving, okay? All four fish are being consumed. But then he gets the idea that he could build a net and just cast the net out from the island. So in T1, he goes through a process of saving, of abstaining from eating all the fish that are produced, okay? Or, alternatively, of cutting back on his leisure, which is another consumer's good that's readily available. So let's assume for the moment that he cuts back on the amount of leisure from 12 to 11 hours and only works 9 hours catching fish. So he can only catch one fish per every 4 hours, or one fish per every 3 hours. Here he can catch, therefore, three fish. Now, notice what happens to his standard of living, okay? Initially, his standard of living was higher before the saving. That is, he consumed 12 hours of leisure with four fish. Now the standard of living has fallen, okay? The reason why it's fallen is because he had saved. He's reduced his consumption. Now, Keynesians would say at this point, well, look, if you have saving, then people are consuming less. And when people consume less, well, there's a lower demand for consumers' goods, and therefore there's no incentive for firms to invest and produce, right? Because people have cut back. But when you go to the Robinson Crusoe example, you can see how ridiculous that is. Okay, in fact, the reason why he has cut back is precisely because he wants more, but not now. He wants more in the future. So basically, he's making a choice not to abstain from consumption forever. He's not cutting consumption forever. He's moving it in time. He's reducing the consumption by a little today so that he can increase it by much more in the future. So that's one of the problems with Keynesian economics, this whole idea that if you cut back on consumption today, for some reason, entrepreneurs are going to interpret it as not wanting consumption goods forever and therefore, or wanting fewer consumption goods forever and therefore cutting back on the amount that they invest. Okay, that's just not true. So what does Robinson Crusoe do? The red is his saving. he saves 4 hours from current consumption, and he works 125 days here and building a net. So, you know, it takes him, the building time is 500 hours, okay? And so during those 125 days, there is a gap in his standard of living. It's lower. He sacrifices present consumption. So now, what's the payoff? The payoff is that 125 days later, he has 9 fish, because he can catch 1 fish per hour with the net. So his productivity has gone way up. It's tripled from 1 for 3 hours to 1 per hour, right? And also, he's only working 9 hours and getting 9 fish, whereas before he was working 12 hours and getting 4 fish. So his productivity has gone way up, got more fish, more than double, and he gets 2 more hours of leisure, okay? So he's way better off than he was. And that's the payoff to saving. That's the payoff to abstaining from present consumption. But the more present consumption that you have, the more present goods that you have, the lower your time preference will be, the lower your preference for the present will be, which will enable you to save even more. So now what he'll do is, let's assume that in T3, he'll decide to save more. So he cuts back by 1 hour. Now he's from 14, he goes down to 13 hours of leisure. And from 9 fish, he goes down to 7 fish. But notice here that 13 hours of leisure and 7 fish, even though it's less than he could enjoy with his current technology and capital goods, is more than his standard of living was when he initially came onto the island and did not do any saving. So he's ahead of the game, and he can save some of what he's accomplished. He can save some of the fish, cut back on his leisure, still live better than he did initially, and now he spends the 3 hours that he's saving, okay? He's taking 2 hours away from fishing, 1 hour away from leisure, saves those 3 hours, okay, and he spends another hour, by the way, replacing the net. So you have to continue to maintain your capital goods. So he's maintaining his net with 1 hour of saving per day. He's working on his net. The other 3 hours that he saves, he builds a ladder, okay, and so that takes him 200 days, you know, 600 hours. Why would he be doing that? Well, he notices, I mean, he's entrepreneurial, as we all are. He looks around, he sees that there are coconut trees, but the coconuts are very, very high up in the tree. He can't reach them with a stick, so he's going to build a ladder. It's a big capital good. It's going to take him a long time, 200 days, work 3 hours a day. But then we come to T4, okay? So at the end of those 200 additional days of saving 4 hours a day, one to replace his net, three to add to his capital. So he's maintaining his capital and then adding to it. The ladder now has been produced. And so now notice what happens. If he wants to produce all that he can in current consumption while maintaining his net and ladder, let's say he spends an hour replacing the net, as we said, repairing it and so on, making sure it doesn't deteriorate, and a half hour a day working on the ladder to make sure that's maintained as part of his capital. He now has 13 hours of leisure, okay, compared to what he had before, 13 hours, and he now has 8 fish and 6 coconuts. So his standard of living has increased tremendously. Not only does he have more fish than before with the same amount of leisure, he has more fish, but he also has, with the same amount of leisure, and more fish, he has 6 coconuts, a new good. So remember what I said before, that some goods you can't produce from short processes of production. And the coconuts is an example of that. Okay, it took him 200 days to build a ladder to access those coconuts. There was no other way to get it. There was no shorter process. But because he had saved, and because he had increased his output of fish, he could save even more to produce the ladder. Okay, so, and then this goes on, and we can just show one more round of this. Okay, so notice now, this will be the last round of this. He then, in time 5, decides he's going to cut back on his immediately previous living standards. He doesn't have to cut back on his leisure, but he does cut back on his fish. Okay, so he takes two hours away from from fishing, and he takes a few hours away from building coconuts or from getting coconuts, and he decides to build the house, which is going to take him 3,000 hours, working 1.5 hours a day on the house for 2,000 days. So eventually, what's going to happen is now he's going to have a house, he's going to have a ladder, he's going to have a net, all of which are capital goods, and all of which increases his standard of living much beyond what he had prior to that. But the key to one of the key lessons, actually two key lessons to understand, is he could only do all this by engaging in longer and longer processes of production, that is, investing his hours of labor for longer periods of time. Okay, in other words, he doesn't want the net per se, he doesn't want the ladder per se, he doesn't want a half-built building per se. He wants the consumer satisfactions that come when all of those things bear fruit in consumer goods. Okay, so he has to, he lengthens the structure of production, and secondly, the only way he can do that is by working less on producing current consumer goods, and that's the saving. So at no point after the initial point is he getting the highest standard of living that he could get. Okay. He could do that. Let's say tomorrow he decides to produce as many coconuts. Let's say instead of replacing the ladder and the net and building the house, he suddenly has a high time preference. He wants everything now. He thinks he's going to be saved, let's say, that he thinks he sees the ship on the horizon and it'll be here, you know, will arrive in a week or two. So what he does then is he produces as much fish, as much leisure time, coconuts, as he can today. He allocates all 24 hours to all of that. Now, if that turns out to be a mirage in the distance and it never arrives, what's going to happen is that the ladder is going to fall apart. The coconuts, the net will eventually wear out, and he will be back to this standard of living in a few years, or maybe sooner. Okay, so he'll be back to this standard of living. So that's the third important point: is that when you move back towards consumption, when you move your labor and other resources back towards consumption, your capital goods begin to wear out. And then over time, your standard of living will decline. And it will decline, it can decline as far as all capital goods is being destroyed. So if today in the United States economy, let's say taxes are extremely high and so on, and people just stop saving, eventually our factories would wear out, labor would be allocated towards producing more consumer goods, which people would begin spending more and more on consumption goods, and that would not be good for the economy, contrary to what the Keynesians tell us, is increasing consumption. It would cause the stopping of all production of new capital goods, and if the movement back towards consumption goes far enough, it will cause a wearing out, what we call capital consumption, not actually eating the capital, but shifting labor away from replacing the capital so that we can eat more and enjoy more today. And that's what happens, for example, when the welfare state grows larger and larger and larger. Okay? It eats away or at the accumulated capital. So hopefully that sort of explains what I was talking about earlier in this lecture. Okay. It ties together saving, longer process of production, time preference, and all the other concepts that are important to understanding how a capitalist economy grows. So let's go to the next slide here. And now let's talk about capital and the production structure in a more sophisticated economy, not in the Robinson Crusoe economy. It's important to focus on Robinson Crusoe because Robinson Crusoe does shows us very starkly what happens and how it happens that we get capital goods. So now let's talk about what Rothbard calls the time market. Other Austrians, such as Roger Garrison, call it the intertemporal market. It's the market where present goods are exchanged for future goods, and we'll explain what those terms mean. So there's two components of this market. The first is the loan market. Okay, that's pretty clear. Okay, well, we talked a little bit about that. That's where the present money, okay, that is where the lender has saved up in the past, present funds and lends them to the borrower. Okay, and what's exchanged for that present money, as we talked about last week, is an IOU, which promises not only to return the original sum of money, but to return a premium, which we call interest. So now we already dealt with that, the loan market. Let's talk about the structure of production. That's the other part. It's actually the more important part of the time market. That is the market. We all participate in that part of the time market. Even if we don't lend or borrow, we participate in the time market because we all work. And we work for capitalists. And most of us, unless we're working directly for a consumer, for example, a doctor or a lawyer who's providing services directly to a consumer, they're not engaged in a time market transaction. But if you go to work for a firm that produces steel, or if you go to work for a firm, for a software firm, if you're a software engineer and you produce software to run factories and so on, the product of your labor isn't sold on the market to the final consumer for years and years. So you're getting wages, you're getting present money, or salary, which is also present money, in exchange for your labor services. Okay, so that's the key exchange in the structure of production. Okay, wages are exchanged for labor services. Okay, also if you're a landowner, and you have landowner meaning someone owns natural resources, and you're providing, you're renting out your land, or allowing a lumber company to come and cut down trees and so on, then you are also engaged in the time market transaction. Okay, so who are the participants in the time market? Okay, and who provides the present goods, who provides the future goods? So the capitalist supplies the present money. The capitalist is the one who saves from, just like the lender. The lender is a form of capitalist. The capitalist in the time market saves some of his past income, accumulates it, and then invests it in buying future goods, in paying labor, in renting or buying natural resources, in buying capital goods, okay, and then combining them, and then later on in time, selling the output from that what we call stage of production. So the transaction looks like this. The capitalist, you have the capitalist on the left side here. He's a supplier of present goods. Okay. Now, what does he supply? He supplies the wages here. Okay. He takes wages and he pays them to the labor. The labor prefers the wages to the product of his labor services. So he's producing something for the capitalist. Whatever it is, he's willing to give that to the capitalist, a week's worth of production that he does in exchange for a week's worth of wages. On the other hand, a capitalist, okay, the red indicates what the party does not have but is exchanging for. The capitalist gets the product of the labor services, whatever that may be, partially finished capital good. And exchange gives up the money wages, which he values less. So it's like any other exchange, okay, whether it's a software engineer who's making $150,000 a year, or it's an immigrant that, you know, working in a sweatshop and making $5 an hour, both parties benefit, okay? Otherwise, they wouldn't engage in that exchange. Okay, so let's go to the next slide here, which points out the function of the capitalist. Okay, so let's just go through these. So the capitalist pays the workers in advance of the sale of the product on the market. That's the key. Think of this. If a worker or if a group of workers wanted to produce an automobile, okay, and let's say the automobile from the time the first iron ore mine is opened up, let's say, before you make the steel, the laborers all along the line would have to postpone their income for 6 years until that stock of automobiles was sold to the consumers. Let's say it takes 6 years to produce an automobile, starting from scratch. Producing the machinery, the mining machinery to mine the iron ore, and then using the iron ore to building the machines necessary to transform the iron ore to steel, and so on. So it might take 6 years. Now, the capitalist assumes that burden. Okay. So if you assume that a capitalist builds cars for the moment from scratch, you'll find that, you know, he'll be waiting 6 years for his income. He'll pay the worker every 2 weeks, and at the end of the whole process, 6 years later, he'll have finished cars, and he'll sell them in exchange for his money income. Well, he laid out money every 2 weeks. So that money that he's laying out is money he couldn't have spent on consumption. So his expectation is that the sale of the car brings enough revenue that it more than exceeds the revenue of the cost of production, to the extent that it pays him for his time preference, for his waiting. So he must give up the present consumption in order to save money to invest in the structure of production, just as Robert De Crusoe had to give up present consumption. But in this case, it's money that could be spent to purchase a vast array of goods in the market economy. That's what the capitalists are giving up. And as I mentioned, he's assuming the burden of waiting for income from the workers. If you just take, say, an automobile assembly plant, and it takes 1 year, okay, they pay the workers, let's say, in total $10 million in wages at the beginning of the year. Let's assume he pays the wages up front. And then at the end of the year, he expects to sell those cars for more than the $10 million he's paid in wages, and forgetting about other costs involved. He assumes that he'll be able to sell them, or he speculates he'll be able to sell the automobiles for $12 million, right? Well, that's a 20% rate of return on the $10 million investment, and therefore, in his mind, that's enough to overcome his time preference. So he pays them before and during the process of production, and he doesn't receive his own income until the production is completed. So when he pays the worker, what he's really getting is not, he doesn't really even want the half-finished products that he's getting from the workers. He doesn't want the partially assembled, automobile base or the wheels that are put on that chassis, which is the base of the automobile. What he wants ultimately is the expectation that he'll get this, to be able to sell all this finished product for money. Now, and it's because present money is worth more than future money, that the capitalist does, in fact, expect to receive more revenue from selling the product than the costs, his wages, his rents, and so on. Which is to say that he's giving up a dollar today in expectation of getting more than a dollar in the future. This isn't the case of a loan, but in this case, it's speculative. He doesn't receive an IOU in return. All that he receives in return is his own expectation that he will be able to sell this. Each dollar's worth of the good, he'll be able to sell for, let's say, $1.10 or $1.20. And he may, in a world of uncertainty, he may turn out to be incorrect. And so it's the excess of the selling price over the costs that we call the rate of return on investment. Okay. Now, Austrians refer to that as the natural rate of interest. That is not how mainstream economists would refer to the rate of return on investment. They only talk about interest as being determined on the loan market, and that the rate of return on investment somehow has to be equalized to the rate of interest. But that, the Austrians really turn it around and say, you don't even need a loan market. Let's say people just directly invested in firms through the stock market. There was no loan market. You would still have a rate of interest, and that rate of interest would be the rate of return, the difference between the selling price of the product and the cost of producing that product, or it's sometimes called the rate of the price spread. Between every stage of production, there are price spreads. So if the steel manufacturer produces steel and then sells it to the automobile producer for use in producing the car, well, in that stage in producing steel, he will pay less in his cost of production than he expects to receive when he sells the steel to the capitalist who's producing the cars. So you have a whole structure of production, which we'll talk about in a moment. And again, in a market economy where people can always move to those areas where there's the highest rate of return, you'll find that the natural rate of interest will be equal in every single stage of production and in every single production process. So not only in all stages of producing cars, but in all stages of producing Hollywood movies or producing tablet computers, there will tend to be an equality. of the natural rate of interest. Because if the natural rate of interest was low in Hollywood movies, or let's say in producing automobiles, and high in producing tablet computers, then there would be a movement in the economy of resources away from the production of automobiles towards tablet computers. Let's go to the next slide. And here's how the rate of interest is determined. Okay, so notice here, this is a supply and demand graph. Okay, and we're going to come back to this, and you can ignore this red line here. This is going to have to do with how the Fed interferes the process. Here's the demand for present goods. Okay, and the people who demand the present goods are the laborers. They're the ones that want the present money on the structure of production. They're also the landowners, people who own oil wells, agricultural land, timber land, and so on. Those people also will sell to the capitalists. Okay? They want present money. Usually they'll rent their land out, or they'll rent their oil well out. So those are the people who demand present goods. Also, the capitalists will demand present goods after he has invested his money. Mainly, he's primarily the, as we'll see, the supplier of present goods. But as a derivative, once you've produced your automobiles, okay, you've invested $10 million, you've produced them, and now you're selling them for $11 million, 10% more, you're now demanding present goods from the consumers, okay? Or the steel producer who produces invests $5 million in producing steel and then sells the steel for $5.5 million to the, say, the automobile producer, he's getting present goods. But for now, let's just think of the demand for present goods is coming from the laborers who want wages and the landowners who want the rents for their land. And who supplies the present goods? It's the capitalists. Capitalists supply the present goods throughout the structure of production. And supply and demand then determines the interest rate. So the interest rate, the natural rate of interest is 5%. The loan market will just go along with 5%, because if you're earning 5% in as the rate of return on investment, then if some people want to invest in your business by buying your bonds, by loaning you money at a bank, you're willing to pay them up to 5%. So really the loan market reflects the rate of return on investment. Okay? You're not going to pay somebody for a loan. If you're a capitalist, you're not going to pay them 6% or 7% for a loan if the going rate of return is 5%. You won't pay them any more than 5%. And hopefully you'll be able to pay them less. But the rate of interest will tend then, rate of interest on a loan market, will tend to be equal to the rate of return on investment, or the natural rate of interest. So we've talked about the natural rate and the loan rate. Those two rates will tend to be equal throughout the economy. Now, there's no other school of economic thought that puts such an emphasis on the importance of the structure of production in determining the interest rate. Okay, it's really the Austrians that are the only school. The other schools focus on the loan market and say that's where the interest rate is determined, and then the rate of return just goes along with the interest rate. Because you would invest in a business, if you could loan at 5%, you would invest in a business at 4%. So they're saying that, so then people only invest in businesses that pay 5% or more. And so the two rates will tend to come together. But the primary, again, without any production, there wouldn't be any loans. The structure of production is the primary determinant of the interest rate. Okay, I will come back to this diagram. But for now you see what how the rate of interest is determined. So now I want to talk about natural economic growth with a series of symbols, and don't let them intimidate you. Okay, they're very, very simple. I actually should have, which I did not, should have put the key to each thing, but let me go through that. So here's, C always represents consumer goods. D represents the demand. And if it's a subscript, C, it represents the demand for consumer goods. P represents prices, and the subscript, C, consumer goods. So wherever you see a C subscript, it represents consumer goods. And as we'll see, there's also a K subscript. That represents capital goods. because we're already using C for consumer goods, so economists tend to use the symbol K to denote capital goods. Okay, and then there's some of the other important symbols. This is the uppercase Greek letter pi. Because economists use P to represent price, we use the symbol pi to represent profit. Okay, so that's profits in the consumer's goods industry. That's how you would interpret this. W represents wages. That's wages in the consumer goods industry. Labor in the consumer's goods industry. We have saving in the consumer's goods industry. So we'll go through all of this in a moment. Let me just, I want to go ahead for one slide here. Go back. Skip something. Oh, I actually did. Okay. Just give me one second. Yeah, I actually didn't. I would like to put up something from on the structure of production, but for some reason it was left out. No, not that one. This is what I want. Yeah, this comes in before the camera. That was never put in. Huh. I never sent it to you, too. Hold this one second here, please. Let's do the mic.
I posted the doc.
I believe you. Okay, we just hold looking for one.
Do you see it here?
No. You printed it as it was. For some reason, I didn't get it. Somehow slipped out. Okay. Next week at the beginning of the clip, I'll just show you, give you a little mathematical example of the actual structure of production. But this will make sense on its own. Because we're just talking, this basically in structure of production, there's a number of different types of capital goods, okay? Starting from, you know, iron mines making iron ore, and then the next stage would be making the iron ore into steel, and then the next stage is to produce machinery with the steel that goes into the factory to produce the cars, and so on. So there's different stages. But for now, it's simple enough to follow this diagram. Okay. Okay, so let's start. Let's say that the economy is producing a certain amount of consumption goods and a certain amount of capital goods. Okay, so consumption goods C, capital goods K here. So there's two sectors in the economy. Unlike Keynesian economists that just look at one thing, that is Y, what they call Y, which is the total output of the economy, Austrians focus not only just on different stages, but they focus on the different sectors. Okay, and the two important sectors are the consumer's goods sector and the capital goods sector. So the Austrians look more closely at the different types of goods that are being produced. So let's do that now. So we have consumers' goods and we have capital goods. Now, how do we change that? How do we, as in the Robinson Crusoe example, how do we save more and produce more capital goods? And this is where the Keynesians run into trouble. Because they believe that, look, if people want to save more, they have to reduce, the downward arrows, notice that, they have to reduce their demand for consumers' goods. And if that happens, the prices of consumers' goods fall. So P goes down, and that leads to, this arrow leads to, a fall in profits. Okay, so they say, since they're only looking at one market, if consumers cut back on what they're buying, then why would firms want to invest more in producing capital goods? That's the problem. That's what they call the paradox of thrift, that when people try to save more and consume less, they wind up driving down income because firms who are supplying the consumer's goods will lay off workers because of the fall in demand and so on. And that's true. They will lay off workers. and that you'll have less orders to the manufacturers, who will then lay off workers. So income will go down, and the economy will fall to recession, and people will wind up actually saving less at their lower income, not more. And that's the paradox of thrift. But what they forget is this other part of the economy, the capital goods industries. It doesn't work like the Keynesians say. It works as follows. Yes, all of these things will happen. There'll be a fall in the demand for labor, therefore the wages will fall. There'll be less labor in the consumer goods industry. But let's stop right there for a moment. Notice that people's time preferences fall. Okay, so what they're doing, if you remember, we talked about their consumption-saving ratio. They're lowering the amount they're consuming, and they're increasing the amount they're saving. Okay, so that consumption-saving ratio is right here. So this ratio falls. Okay? Now, that means that there's less consumption, but there's more saving. Numerator drops, denominator increases, and so saving is going up. But what that does, if we go back to our diagram, let's go back for a moment. For a moment, ignore the S plus change in the money supply. Just assume that this is an increase in genuine saving. Okay? This is an increase in genuine saving. So this curve moves to the right. Okay. So now there's more money saved, put away in banks and so on and other financial intermediaries. At 5%, saving is much more than the and now we're talking about the entrepreneurs going out on the loan market to try to get cap, you know, borrowing from banks, borrowing from you and I as savers, and through the banking system. So we're introducing the banking system here to make it easy. And so what they will do then, the banks will find that there's excess saving. They can't loan out all the money, and we're assuming there's no right here, there's no money, there's no creep in money supply. This is genuine saving. This is voluntary saving that's found its way to the banks. And the banks are going to loan out. So the only way the banks can increase the extra amount, or can loan out, the extra amount of saving, is by lowering their interest rate. As they lower the interest rate from 5% down to 3%, the quantity demanded of saving will increase. So we have savings were presently, let's put it out here, $200 million. That was savings. Now it's increased to $300 million, okay, at 3%. There we go. So it's increased to $300 billion, excuse me. So now you have an additional $100 billion of savings in the economy. And so now there's more money to invest in capital goods. It's the fall in the interest rate that indicates to entrepreneurs that there's more money available to invest in capital goods because people are more willing to wait for their consumption into the future. Okay, so let's go back to where we were. So now you see what happens. Interest rates fall. That leads to an increase in the borrowing from banks and so on. And again, this is a natural fall, or it's a fall of a natural interest rate. It's not artificial. It's been caused by increased savings. And that will then cause investment to go up, okay, and these arrows are supposed to be following here. And what is done with investment? Well, it's done with investment, okay, people, entrepreneurs, are going to borrow this money and just leave it lying around. They're going to buy more capital goods. So the demand for capital goods is going to increase. And as a result of that, the price of capital goods will go up. There will be greater profits. This is a profit. There'll be greater profit. It'll go up in the capital goods industry. And they'll demand more workers to expand because of the greater profits. So you'll have higher wages. And so the laborers that are either leaving the lower wage consumer goods firms or are being laid off, those laborers move from here, labor shifts from C, consumer goods industry, to capital goods industries. And so this labor, decrease in labor here is matched by increase in labor producing capital goods. Okay, and this S is the supply of consumer goods. The supply of consumer goods will fall as they did in the Robinson Crusoe example temporarily. Okay, and supply of capital goods will increase. But if you have more capital goods, that means that workers become more productive. And that's where you get economic growth. That's natural economic growth. So the supply of capital goods go up. You have an increase in the amount of capital in the economy, total capital in the economy, that's K. More capital per worker, Mises always stresses this, Ludwig von Mises, more capital goods per laborer in the economy, because population hasn't changed, but there's more capital goods, means that labor is much more productive. And that means that their productivity goes up. This, we call this the marginal product of labor. Each laborer can produce more than he or she could before. And ultimately, when all the capital goods have been built and are in place, you get an increase in the supply of consumer goods. So just as in the Robinson Crusoe economy, you get more capital goods. Well, let's start from the beginning. You get fewer consumer goods initially. Then you get more capital goods being built. When the capital goods are in place, you get a greater supply of consumer goods. Okay, so the supply of consumer goods will eventually go up, as I've shown here. Okay, so it rises, and with increases in the supply of all consumer goods, the prices go down. So that's the fall prices. That is economic growth. When prices go down, even if money wages haven't changed, we have to look at the last entry here, there'll be an increase in real wages. That is, prices will fall, the denominator will fall as more and more consumer goods come on the market, more tablet computers, more cell phones and so on, more laptops. We see prices falling. So your real wages are going up in terms of those things. HDTVs are falling tremendously, have fallen tremendously in prices. They were introduced from $20,000 to $599 today for better quality TVs. That is the ongoing sort of invisible process of economic growth. You don't have people thrown out of work. You have them shifting jobs. They may leave or even be laid off in consumer goods industries, but eventually they're shifted to capital goods industries. As long as there are no barriers to their shifting, unions or wage rates that are being propped up in some other way. So just to put that all in words, the increase in saving and temporary fall in consumption, I'm reading now from the slide here, does not cause the economy to fall into recession, as the Keynesians would claim. It is the means for shifting labor. You have to have it. You have to have that fall in the demand for consumption goods. In order to shift labor from producing iPods, jeans, hamburgers, to producing more factories, more mining equipment, new research and development, and so on, more software. And you need those additional capital goods, by the way, to use any technological breakthroughs that you're getting. It's not enough simply to have a new technology, okay? Especially if that technology requires using more and more sophisticated capital goods. You have to have the capital, too. So if you think about Robinson Crusoe, he may be the best engineer in the world. He knows how to build everything. But if he doesn't save, he can never build his boat and his net. Okay? In other words, if he has a very high time preference, likes to eat the fish that he's catching by hand, doesn't want to cut back for a year on his consumption of fish, then despite all of his knowledge, he cannot use that technology of building a boat. Okay? And that's why, by the way, poor countries compared to, let's say, the U.S., are much less productive. They can read engineering manuals. They can read manuals about the latest technology. They can send their students to the United States and go to engineering school and go into, major in various sciences and so on. They can get all that knowledge. But unless they have the capital through saving of their own people or through allowing foreign saving and investment in, they're not going to be able to increase the productivity of their laborers by building more capital goods. And that's the key function of multinational firms. Okay? It's to spread saving throughout the world and spread higher living standards throughout the world. So, as we say here, the increase in saving allows more investment. That lengthens the structure of production, allows longer and longer production processes to be built and used. Okay, and it increases the amount of capital and the labor productivity. That's the key. The reason why farmers in the United States are so much better off than farmers in the U.S. 200 years ago is not because farmers today work so much harder than farmers did 200 years ago is because they have better capital goods to work with. It's not just technology, they have better capital goods. Okay? That is, they have tractors, diesel-powered tractors that are run by computers and so on. They're calibrated by computers, they're run by computers and so on. So this whole process of saving doesn't bankrupt the country, doesn't cause recession. The process of saving and not consuming. And by the way, when we say saving, we don't mean not spending. We mean spending on capital goods rather than consumer goods. So it doesn't mean not spending. It simply means not spending on consumption in the present, but postponing it to the future. And that raises everyone's standard of living. Okay, I will just begin, go over this slide about business life theory. We're going to save this for next week. And next week I will have up the sort of a chart showing the structure of production and how goods move, capital goods move through the different stages. So there's a number of things that a good business cycle theory must explain, a number of facts about the real world, a number of phenomena that we observe with business cycles. And let me just introduce the topic, let me just go through them. So the first is, why is it that inflation is always followed by recession or depression? Okay? And why does the business cycle repeat itself? The business cycle being generally having four stages. You have the upswing, that is the period of prosperity. You have a point at which, at the top of that period, there's a crisis of some type, a breakdown, and then you have the recession where you fall back into where profits fall, standards of living fall, wages fall, you get increase in bankruptcy and unemployment. That's the downswing. That's called a recession in today's world. And then you hit bottom. Okay, that's sometimes called a trough. Okay, the very bottom of the business cycle. And then there's an upswing again. So basically, it's a boom and a bust. The boom eventually breaks down at some point and it turns into a bust. Now, in the early 19th century, let me just say something about the term recession, actually the sort of depression. The word panic used to be used because that was the most distinctive feature of the breakdown. Everybody panicked, rushed to the banks to get their money out, and then the financial system began to collapse, and then you got a collapse in business activity. So initially they were called panics, but then it was decided that that's really a very, very scary term. And so they substituted the word crisis. So later on in the 19th century, things were called crises. Unless they were really bad, then they were called panics. It was a panic of 1907. Just as there was a panic of 1819. But many of the periods of breakdown were called crises. And then later on, the panic of 1907 scared people so much that the term depression began to be used. Okay, so that's a nicer term, right? Business is a little bit depressed, right? There's no panic, it's depressed. But then we had the Great Depression of the 1930s. We came out of that, the economics profession, the government decided never to use that term again. You know, we were not ever going to have another depression. So they began to call it a recession, which was even a softer term. Recession means that, business is receding, moving back away from its previous peak. Okay. But then we had the recession of 1980 to 82, which was really a terrible recession. We had a recession of 1990-1992. And we began to hear in the 80s, after that bad double-dip recession of 1980 to 1982, we began to hear a number of terms. Soft landing, that is the economy is just going down, but it's landing softly. Or sideways waffling. It's not really a recession. It's moving sideways. It's not growing. All this nonsense. It's all a depression. I mean, that's the term that Austrians have always used, and that's the term that we'll use. It's a depression. You can call it whatever you want, but the facts are usually the same. And you have a prior inflation, and you have a breakdown, a fall in real activity, and problems in the financial system. And then two, you have to explain why the business cycle has a much greater effect on the capital goods industries than on the consumer goods industries. You don't see during recession Sears or Walmart or Wendy's going out of business. They suffer losses. They're not going out of business. But you do see construction firms going out of business, steel firms going out of business, going bankrupt. You see a much greater fall in the production of capital goods, much more unemployment in the capital goods industries than you have in the consumer goods industries. So that has to be explained. Also, why all of a sudden, after entrepreneurs, most entrepreneurs have been earning profits during the boom period, why do they all suddenly together make errors? Okay. Normal times, most of them are earning profits. Some of them are going out of business, but most of them are earning profits. Do they suddenly become stupid or mistake-prone? Do they suddenly become not able to forecast the future? Why do they all make malinvestments at the same time? It is bad investments. The Keynesians never explain that, and they can't explain that because they don't focus on the microeconomics of it. But the Austrian, that's the key question that the Austrian theory addresses and answers. And then finally, why is it in most, well, in all pre-World War II business cycles, prices fell, okay? They don't fall anymore, but why was it that they did fall in pre-World War II business cycles? And why did they at least slow down, the rate of increase slowed down in current day business cycles when we have the Depression? Okay, well, we'll answer those next week. We'll go through the structure of production. A diagram of it, very famous diagram, it's called sometimes the Hayekian triangle. So we'll talk about that. That's just what I left out of this week's. But I'll take questions right now.
Okay. In the chat. Why natural interest rates tend to be equal to all sectors?
Two questions, okay. Okay, so there's one question of why natural interest rates would tend to be equal if all sectors have different risks by its own nature. Okay, that's a very good question. When we talk about the natural interest rate, we're talking about the pure interest rate, the difference in value between present goods and future goods. Okay, there are other parts of the interest rate. We call them interest rate components. They're not the actual interest rate, but they're components. So if you expect inflation, if inflation is expected, then you'll tend to have let's say expect 3% inflation. Then there'll be a component of 3% added to the interest rate. The interest rate is 5%, the pure interest rate. People will not loan out below 8% because if they loan to 5% and prices went up by 3 over the course of the year and they were paid back 5% more, that 5% more, the money they paid back would only buy 2% more. You'd have to subtract the rate of inflation from the interest rate. So in order to get 5%, if people expect inflation 3, they will add that. Now, that's one. The other thing is the risk component that this person is referring to. And the point there is that, yes, that's absolutely true. So you see different rates of return throughout the economy in the real world. But they're all of them, underlying that is the pure interest rate, the difference in the value between of present goods and future goods. So let me say a few words about this risk component. For example, 90% of Hollywood movies don't make money, okay? Maybe even 95%. For every movie like Jaws or Star Wars or more recently, we have other big movies very recently that have made a lot of money, you know, Batman and the Spider-Man series and so on. You get 10 movies that don't make any money. So there might be a 200% rate of return. But when you or the successful movies may make thousands of percent. They may make 10 times what they've invested. But you need that because there's 95% that fail. So if you average out everything, it would still come to 200%. Okay? So there might be a 200% return on your money, even though some of them are getting nothing. Most of them are getting nothing, and others are getting 10,000% or 1,000%, 10 times their money or their investment. So you need that 200% because because people realize that making Hollywood movies, producing Hollywood movies, is much more risky than for example, producing bread. So in the production of bread, you may have a rate of return of 7%. Okay, there's only a 2% risk component. Okay, instead of 200% in Hollywood movies, there's a 195% risk component. So the less risky production process is perceived to be, the lower the interest rate will be. But that's not the interest rate, really. Economists understand the interest rate as the pure underlying rate. Austrians call it the pure rate or the natural rate, and mainstream economists tend to call it the real rate of interest. So there's no denying that there's a difference, that there's a dispersion of rates of return. And that's true in the loan market too, by the way. That's why you or I may have to pay on an unsecured loan, let's say on our credit card, we might have to pay 20% a year. Whereas some company like Microsoft may be able to pay only 8% or even less, maybe 5%. And the U.S. government, which is perceived as even less risky than loaning to a Microsoft, you know, receives maybe 2% on long-term on long-term loans. Okay. And let me look at another. Okay, someone asks, you put your money in the bank has more money to lend, the cost of borrowing that money, that is the interest, then goes down because there's more money to lend. I wasn't looking at the question. Okay, I wasn't looking at the question. Sorry about that. Here's a question. Why can't simple inflation cause the business cycle in the following way? Inflation leads to an art. Well, I'll address that after, okay? I want to stick to the structure of production. I will come back to that because that's a very important question. Okay, this is more germane to the structure of production. The fact that the services industry is not engaging in the time market, does this mean that it does not add the same value to the economy or does not accumulate as much capital? When people say you can't have only services in an economy, well, let me say something about that. There's retail services. Now, retail services are the last touch of production, okay, that is having retail people and having store of goods. That's the last stage of production for consumers. So that, for example, a shoe salesman is pretty much getting the income that he's generating that very day. Okay, he may be getting paid a little bit in advance. Okay, but he's generating income by selling the shoes that very day. So he's not engaged in a time market. Okay, that doesn't mean he's not adding value. For any industry to exist, it has to add value. So they are adding value to it, but it's almost instantaneous. In other words, the money that he's getting paid, there's still a return on it. Let's say there's a one-week delay, so you pay him and then he sells the shoes and so on. So then there's a tiny bit of interest there. You're paying him slightly less than the full value that he's adding to the firm. So there's interest return in the retail industries. Okay, it's really, for example, a hot dog vendor, even a hot dog vendor has some capital that somebody, for example, in New York City, where I teach, there are hot dog vendors all over the streets. So you have to invest a little bit of capital. And so there usually is some capital. McDonald's, which is a retail, part of the retail industry, retail services industry, has capital. It has ovens and has grills and so on. So that's one part of the answer. The other part of the answer is that many services, such as accounting services that people provide, financial services and other types of services, are provided much higher up in the stages of production. So they are higher order services. So even though they're services, they're not directly serving consumers. So you can have a country, for example, that has all services. Okay. Don't forget the U.S. economy is part of the world economy. You can't just have services for a whole closed economy, but you can have certain areas or even a whole country really just providing services. So if you just think of New York City, let's say, we're getting, there's no really, they don't really make anything in New York City, right? I mean, anything tangible. There's hotel services, there's restaurant services, there are financial services, and so on. Nothing is really, there's no industry in New York City, or there may be some of it, there'd be very, very little. There's some wholesale services, there are obviously warehouses in New York City, but you can have a certain area or big city or even a small country basically being a service economy. The people who criticize service economies do not understand international trade, okay, and the whole idea of comparative advantage. Okay, I hope I answered that question. Why does the natural rate of interest, here's the second question, equal the return on investment? What would be the capital's incentive to invest? The capitalists would invest because of time preference, because they believe that the 5%, the natural rate of interest, I see the problem here. The natural rate of interest is the return on investment. That is the return on investment. The Austrians just call it the natural rate of interest. Okay? So the capitalists' incentive to invest is to gain that difference in price spreads. That is, the $10 million investment versus the $12 million, let's say $11 million return on the investment a year later. That 10% is what it takes to get them to give up the present $10 million to the laborers and the landowners in exchange, and to other higher order capitalists that sell them capital goods. In exchange, they get the expectation that the finished product will bring them $11 million, 10% more. If you're asking why the loan rate of interest equals the natural rate of interest, the same thing is true there. So you can expand your business by getting people to invest directly in it through the stock market or by getting people to loan you the money. So people who operate on the loan market are a little bit more secure. Their investment is still risky, but lenders, okay, for example, bondholders, if you hold the bond of Microsoft, you get paid before, okay, you have a prior claim on the returns from the firm prior to the stockholders and to the owners. Okay, so they suffer the loss or they earn the profits. So if you buy their bond for 5% and the return on investment is 6%, they get to keep that extra percent. But if the return on investment is only 4%, they still have to pay you 5%, and it comes out of their profit. They get a lower rate of profit. But as Austrians stress, whether you invest directly through stocks or through direct ownership, or whether you lend to a company, you're a capitalist in both cases. Your money is at risk because the company can lose so much money that the stockholders get wiped out, and then and part of the bond, part of the investment by bondholders is wiped out. So in some cases, the bondholders will take over the company, but the company will only be worth half of the value of the bonds, or nothing. We have another question. If the cost of capital declined because of central bank credit policy, could that encourage the substitution of capital for labor and result in lower wages, particularly at the lower end of the wage scale? Initially, that would not, we'll talk about this next week, but initially, the decrease in the interest rate would not result in lower wages. Okay. In fact, what would happen is that in order to build the additional capital good that you think you can build with this extra credit that's been injected, this false or created credit that's been injected, you're going to have to pay workers more. Their wages are initially going to rise because when you get that newly created money through the banking system, if you're a firm at a lower rate of interest, you begin to hire more workers. Okay, you begin to demand more capital goods, and the capital goods firms will hire more workers. So if you want to expand your factory space, then more construction workers will be hired. And so the workers will leave consumer goods industries. That's the only way to get them to leave consumer goods industries is by raising the wages in the capital goods industry. So initially, you get a movement of labor. Okay, this whole idea of substituting capital and labor is not doesn't occur as a result of that process. What is the main difference, someone asked, between supply-side economics and Austrian economics? The main difference between supply-side economics and Austrian economics is there's a couple. But on the one hand, the supply-side economists, though they're better than the Keynesians because they say you really can't, demand really doesn't drive the economy. You have to have production. And in order to have production, they do believe you have to have investment, and you have to have incentives to invest, so you have to have low taxes, and you have to have more people working, so you don't want to discourage work for high taxes on labor. So they believe that, but they don't have any notion of the structure of production. They don't particularly understand how that works. And if you push them, they would probably say, well, yes, an increase in demand for consumer goods will increase the demand for capital goods, or a fall in demand for consumer goods may decrease the demand for capital goods. But they don't usually make that sort of an error. Okay? The other way that they're different is that Austrians believe in sound money. The supply side, they're actually better than the Keynesians again. Their monetary policy is usually to target a price of gold. Okay, so if you set the price of gold at, let's say, $1,800, and then you have the Fed take money out of the economy if the price of gold goes above $1,800 and add money to the economy if the price of gold falls below $1,800. So they think that the price of gold can tell you if there's too much money in the economy or not enough money in the economy. That is not a real gold standard. That's called a gold price rule. You still want paper money, but you want the Fed to operate to change the supply of paper money, fiat money, by focusing on targeting the price of gold. So that's another difference there. And also, someone has pointed out, they always tend to want to put more money in, when the price of gold falls. So they always think there's an insufficient amount of money in the economy. So someone, as one other Austrian has said, I think it was Roger Garrison, supply fighters want sound money and plenty of it. Okay, so they don't want a really sound money regime. They want sort of a gold-plated gold standard. Some people have called it a price rule monetarism. The monetarists wanted to set the rate of increase of the money supply at a fixed rate, 3%, 4%, 5%, whatever it is, and then strictly adhere to that rule. Well, supply fighters don't want to do that. They want to fix the price of gold and then stick to that price. However, if the price of gold, for example, one plan said if the price of gold goes above 10%, above the market price, or above the price that you targeted, if it shoots up, then they don't want you taking money out of the economy. They want you to adjust the price of gold upwards because they think it's too much. You have to take too much money out of the economy and you cause a recession. So they tend to be inflationists in that respect. But again, let me just say that the reason why they are good or better than the Keynesians is because they do understand the incentive effects of taxes, or the disincentive effects of taxes, that discourages work and investment. Okay, let's go back to the question, which I promised to come back to. Why can't simple inflation cause the business cycle in the following way? Inflation leads to an artificial increase in demand for goods and services. Businesses expand and adjust as a result, and when inflation of the money supply ceases, a recession ensues. Okay, simple inflation, meaning that the Fed prints money up and sends it to the U.S. government, the U.S. Treasury, to pay its bills with. Okay, that's simple inflation. It doesn't go through the banking system. So let's say the government pays military contractors and they pay for computers to run missiles, to guide the missiles and so on, and they subsidize farmers. They pay the farmers money and they use some of it to pay for Social Security and so on. And then when that money's spent, it raises prices in general. It doesn't. The people who receive that money, let's put it this way, the farmers, the military contractors, they then go home and they're like anyone else. They split that additional income between consumption and saving. So some goods, consumption goods, will rise in price, and others will not. Okay, so the people that benefit are the people who get the new money first and the people that they buy from. And the economy is distorted in the sense because, let's say you get, these are high tech, people like high tech stuff, so they buy more tablet computers, so the prices of tablet computers go up, but they're not particularly interested, they're not foodies, they're not interested in fine restaurants, so they the price of restaurant meals go down. Well, it's true, if the Fed stopped expanding, if you stop having money money printed to pay the government's bills, if they balance their budget, let's say, then what would happen is that suddenly you'd find the demand for tablet computers falling and the demand for restaurant food shooting up again. Well, that's not a business cycle. That's just fluctuations in various markets. I mean, the government can do that. The government does it all the time when it increases. You don't even need inflation to do that. If the government taxes one group and then puts subsidizes another group, well, the prices of the things that the people in the subsidized group think that they buy, those prices go up. And the tax people who have to pay the taxes, the price of the goods they buy go down. If the government stops that subsidy program, okay, if there's no inflation here, they can stop it and cut the taxes back to what they were, then you're going to find the reverse happening. And you'll have some industries now suddenly finding out they've overexpanded, others finding out that they can expand again. But that is not a business cycle. It does not systematically increase the capital goods industries at the expense of the consumer goods industries. It causes changes in demand for different consumer goods. Okay. So that's how I think I'm going to answer that question. Here's another question. Can an increase in the money supply result in higher prices for financial assets without increasing the price of consumer goods? That's a very good question, and by asking that question, you already show that you know more than Keynesians. Yeah, that can happen, certainly. Actually, not just Keynesians, but mainstream economists in general. It can happen for a while, that the money goes into assets, that financial assets, real estate assets, and so on. So that's what's happening today. We're getting a boom in Midwestern farmland. We have a boom in housing prices in Washington, D.C. and in New York City. The real estate has reached a new peak in those places. We have a boom in commodities. The producer price index for commodities has recently reached a new high. So we have booms in certain things, but not we don't have that new money yet moving into consumer goods industries. And there's various reasons for that. Okay, part of the reason is international competition from China, the fact that a lot of the money is being held abroad. 80% of or 67% of all U.S. currencies is being held abroad in countries that are facing inflation. To the extent that people increase their demand for dollars as the supply is increasing, that will blunt some of the effect of those new dollars on U.S. consumer prices. Because people are holding them in their own economies and using them to purchase things on the underground or black market economy in their own countries and so on. So eventually you will get consumer price increases, consumer goods price increases. And one other point is that we still have growth. Okay, we have growth in the economy, so there's consumer goods are increasing as we're beginning to come out of this recession. So that will increase the supply of consumer goods will tend to offset the price raising effects. Okay, send me more questions here. They're going out.
The supply side areas focus on the Laffer curve.
Yeah, that's a good. Let me go back to that supply side question actually, because there's something interesting else, that I can say about it, and that is that supply siders believe that if you cut taxes, you increase increase the amount of income, or you can have that effect. So there are two things that you have to talk about when you're talking about taxes. One is the tax rate, okay, and the other is the amount of tax revenue. So let's say you lived in, you have a socialist economy and the tax rate is 100%. What would the effect of that be on income? Well, according to Arthur Laffer, who's one of the gurus of supply-side economics, and everyone would agree with him on this, your income will be zero. Okay. So from that, he says, as you cut taxes to 90%, to 80%, and by the way, let me just step back for a moment. Not only would your income be zero, but because your income is zero at that very high rate of 100%, tax revenues are zero. The government doesn't collect any taxes because nobody produces anything. As you lower the tax rate, you get an increase in income and therefore an increase in tax revenues. At 90%, you get more tax revenue than you do at 100%. And let's say at 60%, you get more tax revenue than you do at 70%. Because even though the tax rate is lower, the increase in income has been great enough that it offsets the lower tax rate. Now, he draws so that at some point, you know, it could be 40% tax rates or 20% tax rates or 50%, you reach a maximum point. That is that at that tax rate, you're earning the most tax revenues, or you're squeezing the most tax revenues out of the economy as you can. Okay? Once you go, let's say it's 40%, that's the for them, for the supply side, that's the optimal amount. They like that because they say, look, we can cut taxes and we can increase government revenues. So we got two good things. So they like taxes. I mean, as policy advisors, they like higher tax revenues. Not higher tax rates, but higher tax revenues. But as Mary Rothbard always said, what is so good about that? Why do we want to have the government have more tax revenues? But the supply side say, below a certain point, let's say 40%, as you begin to cut taxes below that, then the effect of the lower tax rate begins to outweigh the effect on income. So then your tax revenues begin to fall. And as that happens, then you're moving to lower and lower tax revenues. Now, the debate that went on between supply side and the Keynesians during the Reagan administration was that supply side, the Keynesians said, the Reagan tax cuts are going to cause government to lose tax revenues. And the supply side responded, well, that's ridiculous because they don't take into account the fact that taxes have disincentive effects on working and on investment. So if we cut taxes, they were saying back under the Reagan era, or during the Reagan era, if we cut taxes, people will work more, will invest more, and we'll be on the increasing side of the, they believe that we were on the increasing side of the Laffer curve. So that if they cut tax rates, they promised us we'd have lower and lower deficits because your tax revenues would actually increase at the lower tax rates for the reasons that I specified. That did not happen. And so that was one of the reasons why supply side economics was discredited. Okay, tax revenues actually fell, which I thought was great. I mean, I think that's fine. Cut taxes, and I hope tax rates fall, tax revenues fall. I don't want the government to have more money to tyrannize over us with. And to interfere in our lives with. But see, because they made that prediction, that is the supply fighters, the Keynesians jumped on them and they were discredited after that.
How they hate tax loopholes.
By the way, that is one of the reasons why the supply fighters hate tax loopholes. They want to close all tax loopholes, okay? And then begin lowering rates. Okay, that's usually their plan. Okay, I'll stop here, and I will see you next week. Oh, by the way, before you leave, there will be a midterm posted for the first three lectures, consisting of 20 multiple choice questions. You know when it'll be posted?
Probably tomorrow.
That midterm will be posted tomorrow. So good luck on that. Have a good evening. Good night.